Thomas. Harriet is a home educating mum. She says she found herself baffled and captivated by watching her three children learn. And so she took some Open University courses on child development and early learning to see if she could figure out what was going on here. You know, get to the bottom of that question. How the heck do they know that? As the children started to acquire this knowledge, and she had no idea where it had come from. She has an academic background in social anthropology and science policy, and she's also a PhD student researching home education and literacy at the University of Birmingham, and she's a research associate at the Institute of Education at the University of London. Dr. Alan Thomas is a developmental psychologist, and he's been a teacher at all levels, from primary school right through to university, in the UK and in Australia and Ireland. He says that studying home education, and he's worked with nearly 200 families in the UK, Australia, around. He says that home education has been great for his own informal learning, that he's been exposed to all sorts of stuff, a vast array of things, and that he quite often surprises children with how little he knows about certain things. Harriet and Al have worked together. They've published a joint work in 2008, which is called How Children Learn at Home. That was how I first came across them. I read that book and I just thought it was really cool. And they're currently engaged in a research project on how children learn to read at home. And so they're going to be telling you a little bit more about that in their session. So if you could please welcome Alan and Harriet. Thank you.
Okay, I'm starting off. You hear me okay? So we are trying to locate literacy, learning to read, within mainly within autonomous learning. Just to sort of give a brief introduction, I'm a developmental psychologist. I've got an interest in, interested in how children learn. And this came partly from my dissatisfaction with learning, with teaching in school and learning in school, as a primary teacher, as a secondary teacher, and as a teacher, teacher trainer. However, there was a whiff of autonomy about me at the time. When I was teaching 8-9 year olds, on one occasion we. Once a year, they had this trip away. This was in the late 60s, so we arranged a coach to take them from the east end of London, where I was teaching them, to Epping Forest. And before we went, the head teacher came in and he said, this has to be educational, this trip. You know, we must come back with some learning that the children have done. So I know all about the flora and fauna of Epping Forest, which is where we were going. So he said, I'm going to draw out a list for every child who has to go around and name these, find the examples of these plants and so on. So I thought my sort of heart fell a bit. But I said, yeah, okay. You know. So we got in the coach and we were just setting off and suddenly the head came tearing after the bus. He was shouting, I could see what he was saying. You've forgotten your papers. So I said to the kids, smile and wave back. And so they did. They're very loyal, those kids. They did. And we got to Epping Forest. We did everything that you wouldn't be allowed to do now, talking about risk and so on. It'd be impossible now. Anyway, we were coming back, we were waiting for the coach, and we had to wait a while. I suddenly had a panic. I thought, God, we haven't got anything. So I said, grab any bits of grass, anything you can find, and put them in any bags you can find that you've got. So we went back to school and said, oh, I'm sorry, we forgot to take the things, but look, we've got all this stuff and so on. And we can sort of analyse and describe everything we've got. And he was happy, I was happy, the kids were happy. So there was that sort of whiff of autonomy about me at the time, radicalism at the time. Anyway, I thought there must be a better way. This is what I really came to. It must be a better way of learning. And I did all the research I could about what was missing from learning. And at the time, it was what I thought was individualized teaching. I reasoned that at the time, that if you had a teacher and a child and they could relate to each other, that would be better. Well, of course it is better. But there was no research into it at all, into that, what D.H. Lawrence called the hallowed ground between teacher and taught. So I thought, I'll research individualized teaching. Well, you can't do that in school, obviously. So I turned to home education. And at the same time, somebody offered me the opportunity to live in with the family for a week, which I did. And to cut a long story short, nothing happened. I was there with my clipboard and sort of pen, waiting to sort of note down things from early in the morning. But that was the overall impression of the week. Nothing happened. But it, you know, having said that, that was my epiphany moment, because suddenly I realised that we were sitting around the kitchen, in the kitchen one day, and there was conversation going on, and it covered a wide range of topics. From apartheid, this was some years ago, to what should we have, sticky buns for tea. It covered everything. But in all that, there was the amount of knowledge that was exchanged and so on that went along. You know, and views about apartheid and so on. All these things that were going on. And I thought, this is really amazing. And I did then find some research by somebody called Barbara Tizard and Martin Hughes, done in the... back in the 80s, but it was on looking at children learning at home and in school. These were 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, and what they noticed was the rich language at home compared with school, which was limited to things like, where's the pencil, where can I find the shell, where can we do this, can I go to the toilet, all these sort of things, keep quiet, sit down. It was all that kind of very little conversation. And where it was sort of pedagogical, it was always the teacher taking advantage of a teaching situation if a child is looking at something that might be of interest to that child, which is, to the child, from the child's point of view, totally boring. So I did find that, and then I decided to research home education in detail across the board. I ended up studying about 100 families in Australia and the UK, interviewed 100 and observed a lot of them at the same time, and I found a completely wide range of methods, from more like school than school. The one family had a bell that they rang at 9 o'clock to start school, to, as I said, nothing happening at all. Yeah? Totally autonomous, totally, as they call it in Australia, and I like that term, natural learning, not autonomous learning, just natural, that's how children naturally learn. And so I became, for me, there's no big deal in teaching children at home, teaching them in school. That's, anyone can do that. You've got your curriculum, you just follow it. But it's, and with some families, that seemed to work. I've got no problem with that. But I'm fascinated by natural learning, autonomous learning, because that challenges all the mainstream educators' perceptions of what learning is all about. And I was fascinated by that. And that's what I got into. Overall, my finding was that however people started out, they'd always gravitate to be less formal. Everybody, however formal, they become less formal. Hardly there was an odd example of sort of a child would come to 15, 16, and that child had decided they wanted to do GCSEs or something, but then they would obviously have to sort of study more formally. So. This is very exciting for me. As you know, it's a bit like Mike suggested, that you start very formal and you become informal. And that is very exciting, because it means that the home educating parents are discovering something for yourself, something scientific about the nature of children's learning that has evaded all these researchers all over the world, produces masses and masses of reports about education, the best way to learn. Is it better to learn in a classroom where the desks are grouped together or whether they're apart? Who cares? Masses and masses of research, and yet, at the same time, they won't listen to somebody who's coming up with a completely different idea. So I thought that was extremely exciting. So, as I say, I got really interested in informal, autonomous, or natural learning. Best way to describe it is as a continuation of learning from birth. It's just, you don't stop at 7 and suddenly, or 5 or 6 or whatever, and suddenly learn in a different way. You just go learn, you just extend, continue what you're doing. That's the simplest way I found of describing it. And Interestingly, too, part of our research has been sort of used to inform teaching assistants in school. We've got teaching assistants can do Open University study in how to become better assistant teachers. But we've been asked to contribute, and we have been contributing two chapters to one of their readers on informal learning. We call it informal autonomous learning, because we think that is the, if we're getting in to influence them, that can only be to the good. So the next question is, from us as sort of academics, how do children learn informally? How do all these bits and pieces from completely informal learning come together to make a whole, rounded, educated child in their own way? It's easy to see it in school. I'm going to teach this curriculum, then I'm going to measure whether they've learned it or not. A lot of them won't have learned it, but that's the idea. You measure that. And so you can see what they're trying to do, but in home education, it's very, very difficult to show what they do. One parent was told us as part of our research that when the inspector came around this time, I said, sod it. I'm going to say... So what I really think. So the inspector came and he said, what exactly is your approach? So I told him, we just hang out. So he said, well, when you do work, would it be on loose leaves of paper, loose sheets of paper, or in exercise books? When they do any writing, if they do any writing, she said, they do it when they've got reason to do it and whatever. We don't do writing like that. I said, what about maths? And she said, oh, they go shopping, they get pocket money, and she refused to go any further. But it's still maybe not too easy for some parents who are extremely autonomous to accept. One of the things that I did to show how much you can learn was to what one parent had kept massive amount of she'd recorded her child, everything the child did. And she had a stack of books, sort of exercise books, but that high. And she asked me if I wanted to go through them. Oh God, I couldn't cope with all this. But I went in and took every bit mention of number, maths, numeracy, whatever. And there were tiny bits and pieces here and there. But somehow or other, by the time she was 11, her mother did actually got her to do a maths test, with school equivalent. And some of it she didn't know about that they'd done in school, she hadn't done. But about 70-80% of it she already knew. And she'd never had a maths lesson in all her life. And yet she knew it. And that's demonstrating it. Much harder, which is what Harriet and I tried to do, is to explain how all this happens. And that's what we're trying to do. Some parents get fed up with, themselves. This parent who had all these journals said, sometimes I feel there are all these threads, bits and pieces going here and there and everywhere. And sometimes I think, oh God, why don't I just get a textbook and get on with something, So you do, there are those sort of doubts. What one parent called 3 o'clock in the morning panics. Okay, so today the focus is on learning to read autonomously. Virtually no research into that as far as we know. There is some mainstream research on learning to read before going to school, and the writer of that research, somebody called Rona Steinthorpe, who's at the institute where I'm based, she did this study, and she found that just a very small number will learn before they go to school. And she dismissed that as being exceptional. The main conclusion to her work was that children will only learn to read if they're taught. So we're really challenging that. You're challenging that research. We are just like the scribes who try to understand it. My first study, I didn't expect reading to feature greatly, but it did, and I was shocked by this. I thought, home educators, they'll all, all the children will be reading by the time they're 2 or 3 or even earlier, goodness knows. But what shocked me was that some children learned to read. The parents said, they didn't learn to read until 8, 9, 10, 11. And I thought, this is terrible. this is awful, because I was influenced by that. But then what you learn on top of that is that they learn to read quite late, so-called late, but then they were reading like their age group, or much older than you'd be led to expect from their age. And so this was something which is amazing, because in children in school, they don't learn to read by 7, they fall further behind. But at home, you don't learn to read till 7, 8, 9, or 10. That doesn't matter, make a blind bit of difference. So, so there were the so-called late readers. The other thing was the very wide range of experiences of learning. And I wonder, so in school, of course, there's a stigma if you can't enter. You put in a special group. You're behind if you're not reading by 7. At home, parents may be a bit worried if, you know, we can't help but be affected by society's expectations. But the children maybe don't feel that stigma. It doesn't matter to them. Just give you one quote about a child of 7. She's not interested in reading. She only wants to read so that she can read songs for the piano. She's not reading yet, though. She's 7+. I'm not first. She'll catch up. And I thought that really sort of neatly captures people who become to accept that it doesn't matter at what age you learn to read. You learn to read anyway, unless there is a genuine neurological problem. So,
why do you think some people are illiterate then, that don't read? You know, that can't read.
I don't know. I haven't. See, the thing is.
Can I answer that?
Yes, please.
I did some work with a group of adults learning to read. It was quite a long time ago in Brighton, and nearly everybody in the group had a bad experience at school, and nearly everybody there would say the same kind of thing. They say, "I couldn't do it. I was really struggling. The teacher made me stand up and read in front of the class, and they were all laughing at me, and shutters came down after that. You know, I couldn't. I had to kind of opt out." And I'm not saying every adult who struggles with literacy would fall into that category, but it became, for us working there, it became something that you heard over and over again. Yeah.
Sorry, I thought you meant home-educated children would become illiterate. And I was going to say, I haven't come across that. That doesn't mean to say there aren't any, obviously. Yeah. I'm not saying that at all, but I have, in the hundreds, I haven't come across any. So there was one who was severely mentally disabled, you know, that's, but otherwise, no. And none of the other sort of problems I did come across, hardly heard of dyslexia at all. So children didn't seem to experience that. I'll stop there.
Okay.
I'll let you.
Okay. Well, I'm Harriet, and like Julie said, you know, we're a home educating family. And it was being at home with my own children and watching them and seeing the stuff that they got up to that started to get me really interested in what's happening when somebody learns something and what that actually means, what processes are involved. And I got especially interested in how children learn to read autonomously. And when we started, our children never went to school, and we just kind of drifted from a state that was staying at home with babies into something else that we called home education. But we didn't have an educational philosophy. I didn't really have a very clear vision of where we were going or how we were going to get there. So I think Sandra would approve, because it was very day-to-day, moment-to-moment. But there was a bit of an elephant in the corner, and that was the learning to read thing. And a home educating friend of mine at the time, I think she wanted to be helpful, but she said to me, you know, when they start reading, that's when you'll feel that you've arrived. You know, everything else will fall into place around that. Everything else will become doable and possible once they're reading. And so there was this sort of, you know, this elephant in the corner that you didn't want to look at, you didn't want to kind of think too hard about it, but it was there, you know, and sooner or later you're going to have to address the question, okay, what about reading? And at about the same time, I started to pick up on stories. Sometimes you read something in a newsletter or somebody would tell you a little story about a family where the child had just started reading spontaneously, and it would just be like one day they couldn't do it and the next day they could, and you know, and just to really marvel at those stories and think, you know, how amazing, you know, wouldn't that be just so fantastic if something like that was to happen, you know. But I never really thought that that was kind of an option for our family. I thought, you know, that's I don't know, either your child would have to be super intelligent or they'd have to be something sort of super stimulating or spot on about your family environment. That's not the kind of thing that happens, you know, to people like us. And lo and behold, it did. And our elder daughter, she's coming up to six, and she really liked being read to, and she'd sit and look at a book, and she, you know, she knew all about stories and stuff, and sometimes she'd want to write something down, and she'd get me to write it, and then she'd copy it out, and so I knew that, you know, that there were bits and pieces going on, that she, you know, that she knew little bits at least about reading and literacy. But there's no way that I would have said that they could possibly add up to, you know, a coherent enough whole from which she could begin reading independently. But one day she got given a book, and the book was Hop on Pop, which is one of the really basic Dr. Seuss readers, and she got given it by somebody outside the family. And when I look back on it now, I do think maybe that book came into our house with a slightly different status to the books that we had gone out and picked together with the intention that I would read them to the children, because I think the person who gave it to her assumed or wanted her to read that to herself, that that was the intention behind the gift. And so maybe, you know, a little bit of that rubbed off on her, because that was the book that she started reading. And it's a really simple book, but as far as I knew, she had never read anything before. And she loved that book. She really loved that book. She had her nose in it constantly. She carried it around with her for weeks. And then eventually she was done with it, and she picked herself something else to read, and she went off and read that, and then she went off and read something else. And when it seemed to me, it was almost like there was a little clockwork mechanism inside her, and something had set that into motion. And once it was going, she was just off. You know, she was just off on her own trajectory. She didn't ask me to help her. She didn't ask me any questions. She didn't even really say to me, hey, look, I can read now. It's just, you know, she just went off and got on with it. And I was really, I knocked me down with a feather, you know. I just could not believe it. And I think there were two things that really got to me. And one was that she'd done something that just seemed so clever and so complicated, and she'd done it all by herself. And the other thing that was even more confounding was that, you know, I was with her. I was with her all the time. And in the days and the weeks and the months before she was given that book, there was no indication. There was nothing that I could see that would indicate that she was on this great learning curve and that she was on the brink of this achievement. You know, and I just kept saying to her, you know, what did I miss? How did I miss it? You know, how could it have been going on under my nose? And I didn't know. So that's the question that really got under my skin, and it's still there, and we're still trying to answer it. So when Alan and I started researching together, and my special interest was still literacy, and we heard a lot of stories about families where just the same things had happened, you know, just the same as ours, where the children had started reading independently. And one of the things that's really interesting about it is all those stories have sort of broadly the same framework. They're all about children coming to literacy independently or becoming able to read independently. But the detail that goes into that framework is really individual. Nobody tells the same story. And it's the sheer diversity of the thing. It's just amazing. Children who learn in school, there's one theory about how children learn to read in school, and that is that they're taught. And any debate is about what's the best way of teaching them. You know, how can you make it more efficient or faster or better or whatever? But there's just one story. And in autonomous home education, there are just so many stories that we can really challenge that view. And we can really challenge the adjuncts to that view. We can challenge all the assumed basis of the importance of phonics, the importance of phonemic awareness, the rate at which children supposedly progress, the ages at which they progress, the stages that they're meant to go through, the impact of late reading. You know, we can question all those things. That's probably the good side of it as a researcher. The really difficult thing is that what that also means is that there's very little that you can pull out as a common thread or a common experience, or, you know, or by which you could say this is how we can characterise autonomous home education in terms of learning to read. But it's still what we're trying to do. So we thought today, because you're all here, we'd have a bit of a brainstorming session and see how you feel that your children have come to reading autonomously and what you feel to have been the important things in that process. So we thought if we take a sort of a bit of a poll first of all and say how many people here have got children at home who learn to read autonomously? Yeah. Oh, well, are they in the process? I mean, if you've got children at home, you're not intending them to teach them how to read, and you know, then presumably they're somewhere on that journey, aren't they? Okay, is that everybody then?
Yeah.
We're covered. Okay.
So, everybody.
Yeah. So, does anybody want to get the ball rolling then and say what they think the main influences have been? Yeah.
I think us as parents having a love of books.
A lot of people, in the research that we're doing now say, you know, the reading aloud thing is really big. That's the one that really rises up.
Thinking just the conversations and how so much of the learning that goes on with us is just chatting about things, about the language.
Answering questions, really, and being your child's sounding board, maybe. Yeah, right. Letting them make the decisions. Yeah. Okay, you're going to have to write faster than that.
Sorry, miss. Write out 10 times.
And I've been noticed our daughter hasn't started reading yet. She's not five, but I've noticed she has, because I've noticed things that she's learning. She's started to notice which way writing goes.
Yes.
And she started to notice that this bit of all that is a word.
Yes.
And when she could barely speak, when she had just a few words, she made up this word called shabba, which I had no idea what it meant until one day eventually realised it was the text on the page of the story we're reading. So she had made up a word to describe writing that she could see was there, and that she used it to describe any writing.
Yeah.
That is part of reading,
but
isn't usually... Usually we say a child can't read until they can look at a word and say what it is.
How do you think she knew the going along the line thing? Did you...
Because she started asking me, what does that bit say? And I might put my finger on it, or she'll see my eyes going like that.
Yeah.
Or...
It's almost presupposed by what previous speakers said, but being able to see the words as you hear them, hears them said, and being able to establish a correspondence between what's heard and already understood and what's seen.
I think the large part of it is their curiosity about what words do.
Yeah.
What was that?
Curiosity about what words do. So words are they're not like the pattern on the wallpaper. They're something different that's got
I see a real need for it. I've had a friend and she just didn't believe what the parents were reading to her. They thought they were omitting things. So a reason to read.
Yeah.
So you can see a real need.
So motivation. Yeah. Personal motivation.
I don't know how else to describe suspicion. Can I just say one little thing there? That is, I don't know, the grandchild who's just under two, and he looks at picture books. And it's just the fact that it's a book, you know, that's, and that we talk about things. He's got no notion of that there are the odd words in the book. You know, he's not interested, but he knows they're there. And that, you know, that's even going back even further.
Yeah.
Just to go further,
on the reason to read thing. I have a daughter who informed me in no uncertain terms that it was a waste of her valuable time to learn to read, because I could read things to her, and she's very interested in nature, and she just wants to be outside and exploring her environment. She knows a lot about animals and wildlife and stuff. But what has happened is my life is too busy now for the amount of knowledge that she has.
Yeah.
So she gets frustrated with me because she wants to know so many things, and I couldn't keep up with her request for me to read this to her, because she'd look up websites and then tell me to read them because she could read them.
Yeah.
And then I said to her, well, you know, it's not really working because you're getting very frustrated with me, you know, not being available to read whenever you want, so maybe you should learn to read. And now she's learning to read because there's a reason for her to be reading. That is totally separate to, she had no interest in reading as a skill.
Okay.
Not restricting reading to just books. My son learned to read from running motorbike reading in places.
Kind of like words in the environment as well. Yeah, it has. It's almost impossible, isn't it? You can't walk down the street, but you don't encounter something.
He knows the name of McDonald's.
My boys never wanted to follow the words on the page as we read stories. They never wanted to hear my voice and see the words. They've learnt to read literally from reading bus stopping and then instantly know, and they've actually pinned that one down. So how did you know what that said? Oh, that thing was from bus stopping. And they can actually pinpoint the words in their environment they learnt from.
Right.
But they still don't want to follow the words on the page, even though they've they've never wanted that association. They've learnt it entirely without that.
Lovely.
I have to say, a lack of anxiety as well, because I started to teach my son to read, I have to admit, and he said reading is boring. I hate this, and so I stopped. I thought, oh God, that's it, he's damaged for life. And 6 months later, he sat down with another doctor's book and read.
We've heard loads of stories about children who just say to their parents, no, I'm just not doing it, you know, go away. So you don't have much option then, do you?
Yeah, I also have a grown son who learned to read with Hop on Paw.
Oh, yeah.
So I think, and this one was another set of books called Bob books. I mean, having those available where it's just one or two words.
Yeah.
Just so that it's doable and it's achievable.
Just thought of being able to sit next to your parent or someone who can read in a comfortable setting. So just company, I suppose.
And the pleasure of it.
I wanted to just, it's not for the list, but I liked the, was it John Holt's idea, from one of his books, that he said that it's not actually that difficult. It's just we already know the words and the language, we've learned to speak, but it's just the symbols and how we use them.
Yeah.
So just a way to put them down.
Yes.
So it's overemphasized that it's such a very difficult thing to do. For a long period of time.
Storyboarding. My eldest daughter's a very reluctant reader, having had a few months at school. Not saying anything. But she really didn't want to write, wasn't interested in reading either, really. But she's very good at drawing, and she illustrated lots of her own books. And she said, I know what's going on in here, Mummy. Would you write while I tell you what, you know, what the story's about? So I would write for her.
Yeah.
And I think that's played a part in her now learning to read what she's reading now.
So that's quite a few things mixed up there, isn't it? Because of the motivation, because of her wanting it. And then the help, so that it's, you know, it's not like such a huge task, and then the pleasure in doing something together like that, and that interaction.
Okay.
The lady in front of me said something that, you know, when you sit down with the child and read, that's kind of really special time for them. But sometimes I feel like, not to be devil's advocate, but that that in our society sometimes that's the time that not the only time, but the main bit of full-on one-on-one attention that they get. And so I think that it becomes something they do for that.
In order to
is it maybe, you know, what's so important about reading? They're going to learn to read, right? It's not, you know, like you don't necessarily have to read to them for them. I do it too. But I'm just sort of feel like sometimes I have a 2, 4, and a 6-year-old, and, you know, to sit and play another game, sometimes us as adults, we're not able to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I think we substitute. You know, we all like books, you know, probably. And so it's pretty easy to just sit and read with the child, and that's nice time together.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I feel like there's a bit much emphasis put on this 2-year-old doesn't really need to be, you know, we can play with blocks, and we can paint, and we can do these other things. Wanted to say that.
No, I think you're right, and I think, it's a really big problem for, you know, when you're trying to research it, because there isn't a straight line of cause and effect. You can't say that children read because they're read to or because of something else, you know. Once you've kind of broken out of that mould that they learn because they're taught, you know, you really are at sea. You know, there are so many influences, there are so many different things going on that might... You know, you can't have a general theory for everybody. You know, it may be in this particular case, this particular thing was, you know, was a hinge factor, but maybe it had nothing to do with, you know, another child somewhere else. It's really difficult to isolate factors and say, you know, this is the one that counts.
So it's inevitable. In a literary culture, it's inevitable that children will learn to read without being taught. Just as in a linguistic culture, they learn language. And where I think it's from, my contribution, is we're hardwired for the transmission of culture. And that comes out through modeling and the mirror neuron process. So as I'm doing this, I'm making this action, everybody who's watching me, neurons in their head, a certain amount of neurons are firing for this movement. And then as children learn and watch and are exposed to reading, then neurons are firing in their head, just like how they learn to walk and talk.
You're stealing our thunder now for the next bit.
I was hoping to find a night, offer a segue.
And then our children do a lot of writing.
She said about writing things down for a child, but with my daughter it was very much a process that the writing and putting together the words seemed to
so did she write first and then read after that
she's getting
Mine asked hundreds of questions about sounds. If I put this and this together, what was that? What does that sound? And then, you know, there'll be days of, well, what about this and this and this?
Yeah.
And when at points where I couldn't answer his question, I said, well, I'm not really quite sure why that would sound like that and that wouldn't sound. He then demanded that I got a book so that I could teach him what the sounds were like.
So
sometimes when sounds don't necessarily, you know, like bow and...
Yes.
Sometimes
like
they have different... phonetic.
Yeah.
And I didn't necessarily have the answers at that point to give him. He demanded, and he was only like 3... that I went and bought a book to teach him those sounds.
Right. So he was asking you to teach him.
Yeah, Michael was asking me to teach him to read as well.
Sort of as opposed to the other children who say, you know, leave me alone. Yeah, yeah.
Learn that way.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah?
Okay.
Yeah.
Two things happened very close together in our house. First, I discovered my son was worried that when he learned to read, we would stop reading to him. But we discovered that, you know, this is a real fear, that he valued that time so much. And so, you know, we reassured him that this was, you know, continued, because we all love it. And also, we have this, someone mentioned storyboarding. You know, for years, my son has been dictating, and I've been, you know, just typing or writing really quickly his stories. And he was also worried about this. So, you know, I assured him that I would, you know, continue to do this, because I'm much more efficient at typing than he is at writing, you know. And so that happened. And then a few days later, he had this heartbreaking frustration because he got this Doctor Who magazine. It came with a secret notebook, but he couldn't read what he was supposed to do with the notebook. And the older boys at our home ed group kind of knew what to do, and he felt very upset about it. And so when he went home, we had this kind of interactive, animated learning to read program on the computer. He just really has gone for it with like a gusto that, you know, it's hard to describe, because he knows he's not going to lose connection with us, and he knows that he'll be able to do big boy things. And that is suddenly, you know, just suddenly it's happening. It's happening really quickly.
Are we
going to
write down some more? Should we try and see what we can fill out
of the plot? I'm going to spell out enough if I could. just take 1 minute.
Okay.
And take three more and then stop.
Is that all we've got left? Oh my goodness. Right, we'd better get them.
Yeah.
We'd better get talking about these.
you've had your hand up a long time.
Oh, sorry.
No, no.
I was just thinking further from that. One of the things I've noticed from the mailing lists is that mailing list on the home educators on it, something that's frequently reported is that there's a difference between the way boys and girls learn. And it seems to be that this is just averages. You can't talk about individual families or children. But there's a tendency for girls to be more, the motivation for learning is internet messaging.
Yeah.
They want to communicate with the friends they meet. And so quite often at TestFest, a lot of the kids make links of friends at TestFest, and of course they live all over the UK. And they swap internet message IDs at TestFest. And there's now quite a sophisticated network of young teen, college-educated girls with lots and lots of contacts on the internet messaging boards, Skype and MSN and so on. With boys, there is a degree of that going on, but the thing that's been most noticeable is the degree to which they want to be able to play these sophisticated computer games, which require you to be able to read very detailed instructions and interactions. A lot of it is it's not so much now, it's quite often verbal, but they come to a very verbal reason it's all written. And you have to be able to read to be able to play a game. And lots and lots of boys learn to read solely so they can play these games.
Yeah.
Give
me
10 minutes
to
see
what we can pull out of this.
Okay.
Okay.
Just on top of
what
a minute or so. Okay. Yeah, we've got to give you the theory, for goodness sake. just very, very briefly, the way we've initially, you know, this is very tentative stuff that we've tried to explain in very, very simple terms, that literacy, as well as maths and writing and so on, are learned through what we've called, and very obviously again, the informal culture, curriculum of the culture, the informal curriculum, if you like, which is the world around us. Very simple, you know, that's the simplest way I can put it. And we are exposed to the world around us. I don't know about neurons, but I think we've got an innate disposition to acquire the culture around us. You see from birth, and children will just go on doing it. So everything is around us. And okay, so quantum physics you don't learn as you grow up as a child. But part of our culture also is to find out about information that isn't around us. And so children do this when they're young, and it's, you know, it's not a long, particularly long way from finding out about dinosaurs, about how the bike works, to quantum physics. You have to go somewhere else to find out about that because it's not around you. So in our book, we've actually gone into how the role of the parents in learning to read, and in the role of the parents generally in autonomous learning. Then how do we... they obviously play an important part. We've also looked at how the children actually engage with the curriculum. You're not going to learn if you don't do anything. The children have got to engage. And parents play an important part. But children, especially through conversation, that came up again and again, the importance of conversation in children getting their knowledge of the world. And it's how a lot of us learn, actually. We don't write stuff down, anyway. We talk about it. Through play. Play is important, very important for literacy. Labels on your toys, all sorts of things like that that children use as part of their fantasy games and so on. Imitation, observation, practice, yes, practice. Some children at home, read the same book over and over and over and over again. We had one example today. Whereas in school, as soon as you master the book, you go on to the next book, whether you're interested in it or not. So it seems that practice is very important, but children conduct their own practice. So it's a very, very sketchy description of our theoretical approach. So in other words, there's the what, which is all out there, and there's the how do children go about it. And we're still trying to, you know, the more we've learned, the less we know.
We've just got 5 minutes left. There's just one more idea. I just want to run by you quickly and see what people think about this. And, you know, we've talked about the processes, about, you know, the things that children do, and we're also really interested in what reading actually is. And the mainstream theory is that when we write something down, you take the sounds that you make in speech, you transform them into letters, you write them down, and reading is decoding backwards. And you do that according to a set of rules. And in sort of that view of reading, I think it actually makes a lot of sense to teach children to read, because the alternative is to say, you know, we've got these rules, but we're not sharing them. You're going to have to work them out for yourselves. And that's just a bit unfriendly, really, isn't it? But it's a bit pointless. You know, why do they have to go away and reinvent the wheel if that's actually what reading is? So I'm sort of toying with the idea of treating reading actually as something much more general than applying rules to print. It's, reading is a process that we do all the time, and sometimes we use the word in that way as well, don't we? So, you know, we read the situation, or you read somebody's body language, or you read their facial expression, and what we're doing is extracting meaning putting meaning into certain situations, and that children who learn autonomously are simply attaching meaning to different things. They're doing it all the time. They're not singling print out and saying, this is something different and I'm going to approach it differently. You know, they're treating it as part of a world that isn't categorised, and they can use the same learning processes for everything that they do, and reading doesn't need to be something special or different to the way that they learn, you know, what the noise of the doorbell means, or, you know, they learn like mum's annoyed now, or, you know, or whatever it is. It's part of the same process. And I'm sort of toying with that idea and thinking about autonomous education as a whole. One of the things that Alan and I really found is that when you're trying to explain autonomous education to people who don't know it, you tend to fall back on negatives and say things like, well, it's education without a teacher, or it's education without a curriculum, or, you know, it's an education without age-related targets or whatever. It's much harder to say in positive terms what autonomous education is. But I think one of the ways that maybe we could characterise it is by saying it's education that looks for meaning, and that learning to read is looking for meaning in particular things. Oh, yeah.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I can't believe that reading is a wall of decoding. Because I have two children who speak. I can't believe that they can decode every word in the speed they read. Both of them try to read. I have no idea how. But I don't know how they speed read either. But it is incredibly fast. And I trust them, and they do know what they've read.
Yeah. I think, you know, fluent readers don't decode anyway, do they? You know, you just recognise the word when you see it, don't you? And so we're asking children to do it in a way that we don't do it ourselves, which is also a bit back to front, isn't it?
I read on a Times Educational Supplement message board teachers complaining about children's spelling, and they were saying, oh, I can't bear it when they keep saying spelling with W-I-V and various other things. And someone said, is that because we teach them phonics? Because actually spoken language is completely different from written language. And if you're teaching them to spell by how it sounds, they're going to write in their local dialect, so they're going to write in their idiom. And then teachers get really upset that these are common spelling mistakes, that they won't realise T-H is supposed to be like that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of problems with phonics. When you look at it closely, you know, there's a lot of problems with phonics, and you know, and the idea that their sounds made in speech are regular. So you know, if you've got a different dialect or whatever, you know, what do you do then?
Every single parent in the country has unwittingly conducted autonomous education when they taught, in inverted commas, their child to speak. If children can learn to speak autonomously at a very early age, which they clearly do, and they can understand the rules and regulations around speech and language, all we're trying to do as autonomous parents is take that forward to everything else. You know, if a child can learn to speak and understand the context of words, and the same words can mean different things, if they're pronounced in a different way, different emphasis, etc., etc., then surely a child, because they grew up in a speech-rich environment, surely a child can do the same thing when it comes to reading, the same thing when it comes to maths, etc., etc. Perhaps when they start to want to learn about quantum physics, they might have to actually then go into some kind of formal education at that point. But, you know, they'll be well on the way by then. And I think that to me sums up what you're trying to study. If you can understand that children learn to speak, it seems absurd to think they can't learn to read in their own way.
Yeah.
That's my
I think it goes back to the lady earlier as well, because we're really begging the question here, you know, well, how do children in school actually learn to read? You know, maybe the teaching has absolutely nothing to do with that. You know, and all children are learning to read autonomously. It just happens that in some cases these two things are running parallel. So we say, okay, that one's caused that one.
And learning to speak autonomously, it's also, if you're speech rich, you're giving them a comprehension to comprehend their speech. As I know with my daughter, she can comprehend everything very well. She's been very reluctant to learn to read. But I think if I'd pushed her to read earlier, would the comprehension have been there earlier? Although she might have picked up the reading, is she comprehending what she's reading?
Yeah.
But through being speech rich enough, that way,
The comprehension's already there, so those important foundations have been laid.
Yeah.
And now she's just picked up a book and started reading.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is really important, you know, if you reduce reading to decoding, you totally bypass that, don't you? And then what's the point of reading? What's the point then?
Yeah, the problem in schools, I feel, is that they're teaching by rote the words, but not helping them comprehend what it is that they're reading.
Yeah.
Can I just add something to what you were saying about the mystery of reading? My son read Young by Len, he wanted to write. My daughter was 2 years younger and was desperate to keep up with him, so she read Young as well very quickly. And my third son read very late, wasn't interested in reading and really struggled with it. But the other day, for some reason which I can't remember, I was reading something upside down. And so we all started to read upside down. My first son could do it fine, but not as well as me, which is perhaps understandable. My daughter, because I practice more than me. My daughter is very bright, couldn't do it at all, which is really annoying for her. But my son, who we wondered whether he might be dyslexic, could do it better than the other two, but worse than that, could read better upside down than he could write. How does that look?
Yeah, yeah. Well, like you say, it's part of the mystery, isn't it? You know, and a point as to how little we do actually know. You know, how little we do really understand about it.
This is maybe a mystery, though. Maybe that boy read everything upside down.
Maybe.
He just recognises words upside down. So for us, it's a mystery because we know what's the right way. How does he know?
Japanese reading.
I don't see a difference between learning to read upside down in the right way or left to right to left.
Oh, I wish this is gone all day. We just listen to what you've got to tell us, there's our next book.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and you know, I've got to